which is not something I have time for, even if I did have the inclination. I don't. I grab my purse and leave the conference room, hooking my elbow through Cass's and walking her backward. We're off to Manassas. I have to give Vic something to handle. Grab Watts? Why are we... But it's mid-morning. How is there just now a victim? Someone would see something. I'll tell you both in the car. I twist her around to point her in the right direction and give her a swat on the ass to keep her moving. And because we've been friends for 10 years, she just shoots me the bird and flounces down the stairs to find Watts. Vic is in his office. He gives me a distracted good morning, head down as he makes notes on a file, but the sound of the lock turning has his full attention on me. Mercedes, what's wrong? Two things. I tell him the very little I have regarding the newest child, and he nods gravely. What's the second thing? He asks, when I struggle to continue. Deep breath, Mercedes. My mother is downstairs. That has him putting his pen down and leaning back in the well-padded chair. Your mother? Probably. I guess it could be one of the cousins. It's a popular name in the family. But, yeah, it's probably my mother. When was the last time you saw her? She tracked down my foster home when I was 13. That's when they transferred me out of their system to another city. 19 years. And you have an idea about why she's here? My father was recently diagnosed with cancer, I say, and at his raised eyebrow add, pancreatic. I'll go speak with her. Do you want me to convince her to leave? My gut screams, yes. But that part of me that will always, always feel guilty, despite knowing my choices were mine and were right for me, says, wait. And Vic reads that hesitation for what it is and comes around his desk to give me a long hug. I'll see if she's got a hotel. If not, I'll get her set up in one. Not in Manassas, please. Not in Manassas. I promise. I lean my head against his chest, feeling the ridges of the surgical scar even through his dress shirt and undershirt. That bullet changed his life, but it changed our lives, too. Such a little thing to have so much weight. As he pulls back, he smooths the stray wisps of my hair that always fight the clips and ponytails, his hand warm on my scalp as he presses a kiss to my forehead. Go check on that little girl, he murmurs. I'll get your mother settled somewhere for when you're ready. In 27 years, I have never been ready for that conversation. I attempted it a few times, those first few years, but she always shut it down. And now? I nod, blinking away tears that I swear to my dying day are just from exhaustion and stress, and unlock his door. Cass and Watts are waiting at the elevator. They both look blankly at Vic, who just gives them a bland smile and no explanation. In the lobby, I can see her immediately, sitting stiffly in a chair near the desk, a rosary wrapped around her palm so the crucifix rests on the base of her thumb. I've always remembered her as she was when I was a child. Somehow, I've never thought of her as being old. Of course, she is. She's almost 70. But as much as she's changed, it's still immediately her, and my heart thumps painfully. Vic steps to my side, between me and my mother, and as we draw closer, he pushes me along with Cass and Watts, breaking off to stand in front of her. As the three of us walk away, I can hear him address her. Mrs. Ramirez, my name is Victor Hanoverian. I'm the unit chief for your daughter's team. Cass gives me an anxious look. I'm not discussing it, I whisper. By the time we get to Manassas, I will be completely focused on Ava. Watts simply nods.
We're all here for reasons, Ramirez. Just tell me if you need to step away.
That is not something I have ever known how to tell. Once upon a time, there was a little girl who was scared of her father. It was only natural. He'd hurt her so badly for so long. But even now, after so many years, he was still her deepest wound, her most visceral nightmare. She hadn't seen him since the trial, the bits of it for which her presence had been required. She'd sat trembling in the row behind the prosecutor, her advocate by her side, or up in the witness stand, watching her daddy seethe. He'd been so angry. She'd always known to be afraid when he was that angry. When the advocate led her out of the courtroom for the last time, she looked over her shoulder and saw Daddy standing at his table in one of the nicest suits he wore for work, and he was glaring at her like it was all her fault. He hated her, she thought, but it wasn't her fault. It was never her fault. Mostly, she believed that. Her daddy was in prison, where he belonged, and whatever indelible scars he'd left on her, he would never cause her fresh wounds. She was safe. She was healing. She was okay. It had taken her a long time to get there, but the angel had promised that she was going to be okay. And eventually she was. She was okay. Then, she got a letter from her father. She didn't recognize the handwriting on the envelope, but it had both her names in the center, and that bolt of fear. It had been years since she'd been that suddenly afraid. Then she saw the name in the upper left corner, with the prisoner number and the name of the facility. It took her 4 days just to open the envelope. Another 3 to actually read the letter. It started, "My beautiful angel." He wanted to apologize in person. There was so much he needed to tell her. Would she come see him? She didn't want to. She absolutely didn't want to, and yet, she didn't think either of them were surprised when she finally showed up. He'd always had too much power over her. He still looked like Daddy. Older, grayer, more muscled. He worked out with the boys in the yard, he told her, had kept him in the best shape of his life. She was so pretty, he told her, but he missed her red hair. She'd looked so perfect with the red hair. He had a look in his eye, one that her tight muscles and hunched shoulders remembered before her mind did. He was remarried, he told her, to a woman who wanted to save him. They were expecting a baby, he told her, coming in August, and his lawyer thought there was a chance, given how crowded the prison was, that it might make him seem sympathetic enough to release. He had years, decades of sentence left, but his lawyer thought he could be out in a few years, with any luck. It was a girl, he told her, grinning. We're naming it after you, he told her. My own baby girl again, just like you never left. I do love my baby girl, he told her. And his laughter clawed in her bones as she ran away. Once upon a time, there was a little girl who was scared of her father. If he got out of prison, her little sister would be scared of him, too.
24. Ava Levine is a 12-year-old girl who practically glows with health, giving us all confused smiles as she sits on the hospital bed with a pair of familiar teddy bears in her lap. Her brown hair is well tended. She's a good weight for her height and age, and she doesn't have a single visible bruise. But when she follows the doctor's instruction and lies back on the bed, her oversized sleep shirt drapes around the swell of what is either a baby bump or a really bad liver. I don't think any of us actually need the doctor to confirm it's the former. "Shouldn't my parents be here?" she asks when the doctor has finished her exam and helped her sit up. Holmes checks her phone. She was definitely called straight from bed, her hair shoved back haphazardly in a clip that doesn't quite manage to hit contained. She's in worn jeans and a shirt so faded it's impossible to tell what the lettering used to read, her feet shoved into two different kinds of sandal.
"Detective Mignon is almost to your house, sweetheart."
What the shit? Nancy, sitting in a chair by the bed, looks up at us anxiously. It's the same bear. It is absolutely, definitely the same bear. And this is very clearly a pregnant 12-year-old. So why is the rest of it so bizarre?
"Ava," Watts says calmly, standing at the foot of the bed.
"Did you know you're pregnant?"
"Well, yeah," the girl answers, still looking politely baffled.
That's not the answer Watts was expecting, but she's too good to show it.
"Do you know who the father is, Ava?"
"My daddy."
"El mundo está en guerra, por lo que solo hay que dejar que se queme."
"I've been asking for a little sister for years," she continues, oblivious to the carefully contained reactions of the rest of us. "Mom said she got hurt when I was born and can't have any more kids in her belly, so I'm doing it." Her brilliant smile falters a bit when we don't say anything.
"What's wrong?"
"Your mom knew."
"It was her idea, but it made Daddy really happy. He called us his smart girls."
"What's wrong?" she asks again, starting to look a little worried.
Holmes tilts her phone toward me, the screen bright with a new message from Mignone. "Parents are dead. Negative spaces indicate there was only the killer. Tylenol PM packets in the girl's room."
"Ava, do you ever take anything to help you sleep?"
She nods slowly. "Growing a baby is tiring. Mom says I have to get lots of sleep so my sister and I will both be healthy. She looked it up and everything."
"So, if a pregnant child took an adult dose of a sleep aid, the killer probably couldn't wake her up enough to register what was happening."
"Why is everyone so..."
"Ava, what your parents did, it's illegal, sweetheart, and it's not healthy."
"No. Mom has been getting me all my vitamins and everything. I'm fine."
Watts shares a look with Nancy, who leans forward in her chair.
"No matter what you're taking or how you're eating or sleeping, Ava, your body isn't ready for everything that being pregnant or delivering a baby requires. As you get further along, you're going to be in a lot of danger. And when Agent Watts said it was illegal, legally, you can't consent to anything like that until you're older. For a parent to do it..."
"No," Ava retorts, clutching the bears tightly. "My parents love me and we're all really happy. We're not doing anything wrong."
Holmes looks exhausted.
She's undoubtedly been juggling other cases with this one, which probably means she hasn't had a solid night's rest in weeks. I cross the room to stand between Watts and Nancy. Ava, do you remember how you got to the hospital? She frowns at that, her fingers running anxiously along the crinkling gold halo of one of the bears. It's strikingly similar to praying a rosary, and it's everything I can do not to close my eyes against the sight, the memory of the string of metal and glass around my mother's palm. Not really, she says eventually. I fall asleep to the TV sometimes. My dad carries me to bed. You were brought here by a stranger, Ava. Someone who knew that your parents got you pregnant and was really angry about it. She brought you here so you'd be safe until you were found, but... Ava, I'm really sorry, but she killed your parents. There is no good way to tell a child that. I don't know if there's a good way to tell anyone that, if it comes to it, but certainly not a child. She blinks and stares at me blankly. What? Detective Mignone went to your house to find your parents, I remind her gently. He found your parents dead. Someone had killed them. And because she brought you here, because we recognize the bears she gave you, we know it's the same person who's killed other kids' parents recently. No. Her head shakes, increasingly frantic. No, you're lying. You're lying! Nancy and the nurse both rush in to calm her as she breaks into hysterics. No tears yet. The shock is too fresh, but her screams are piercing and pained, and the heart monitor is shrieking right along with her. It's one thing, common and even expected, for kids to deny they've been hurt. But this? To genuinely not even realize? Sympathy stirs for her pain, but I can't bring myself to be sorry her parents are dead. Her mother's idea? Christ, this poor girl. The shock triggers a panic attack, and by the time she's finally calmer, she's in an exhausted stupor, with the oxygen mask covering the lower half of her face. The nurse strokes Ava's hair, a physical comfort that has the girl drifting off to sleep, the teddy bears clutched to her chest. I don't think you're going to get anything out of her for a while, the woman says quietly. Nancy and Cass stay in the room, pulling chairs away from the bed to give some space. The rest of us head into the hallway. Holmes glances back through the small window in the door, then at me. Why was she given two bears? One for the baby. She chokes on that a little. Watts blows out a frustrated breath that's almost a raspberry. She didn't wake up enough to be told your name, and she hasn't read the note that was pinned to her. If you want to head back to the office, you probably can, Ramirez. Do you think there'll be a need to do a separate warrant for the list of who accessed Ava's file? No. Ongoing cases usually garner a little bit of wiggle room, at least for this sort of information. I'm going to send the Smiths to CPS to talk to the clerks. They may be bringing Gloria Hess back with them to question. Ramirez? I know. I can't be there if you talk to her. Because talking to the kids is one thing, if it brings them comfort, and if it keeps them calm to answer questions. Because they've been given my name. Looking through case files is research, not investigation. I am an asset to the investigation, but not an element of the investigation itself. Technicalities, as stupid as they can be, protect us.
But if suspects are brought into a station or office in an official capacity, I can't participate or even observe. God damn it. And I don't actually have a way to get back to Quantico. We came in Watts's car. I should probably check on the other kids who are still here, but I can't quite bring myself to do it. Maybe this is stepping away, acknowledging that I don't have the strength to do this today. I head out of the hospital, trying to decide if I remember where my car is. I can call a taxi if it's at Edison's or Sterling's, but there's also the possibility that it's in the garage at Quantico, and that's a bit more than I want to pay for a ride. My phone rings in my hand, and I don't want to know, I don't want to know, I don't... Why is Jenny Hanoverian calling me? Jenny? Mercedes, she says warmly. My husband tells me you might need a ride back to Quantico. The girls are showing Marlene Magic Mike, so I'm free as a bird. Watts, you clever fiend. I don't want to inconvenience you. I once had to drive to Atlanta because Holly forgot her running shoes for a track meet. Beat that, and we'll talk about being inconvenienced. Holly is her daughter, though, and I am suddenly very incapable of continuing with any kind of argument, because that is a weird and wonderful and terrifying thought. She pulls up in her minivan, the front bumper still sporting the blue paint from when one of Brittany's driving lessons ended in a destroyed toy box, and she takes a long look at my face as I buckle in. And then she spends the drive back, chatting about her vegetable garden and the war she's waging with the invading rabbits. It's a gift, and there's something about it. It's Siobhan, I realize. When Siobhan and I were together, she'd burble on about things because she didn't want to know about my day or my cases. But Jenny is talking because I can't. And it's strange how something so similar can be so different. We stop to pick up a late lunch for everyone, bacon grilled cheese sandwiches, and several different kinds of soup. And a quick glance around the office lobby is enough to reassure me that my mother isn't there. Upstairs, Vic gives me a card with an address and a room number on it, a hotel here in Quantico. But doesn't say a word. I should probably figure out where my car is. Jenny leaves after lunch, waving off my gratitude. She just kisses us all on the cheek, goes for Edison's other cheek after he blushes the first time, and walks off, laughing. If she ever leaves you, I tell Vic solemnly, I'm marrying her. He chuckles and leaves us to our research. After all three of us have proposed to his mother at various times. We spend the afternoon digging through my cases, occasionally sending names to Cass to have her analysts do more in-depth research in systems Sterling can't access. Ava, she reports, is with an obstetrician to have an ultrasound. Her mother bought her vitamins, but they weren't specifically prenatal, and she hadn't had any appointments. Of course she hadn't. Every clinic in the country would have been required to report it. CPS keeps physical and digital files, Sterling says suddenly. Given that none of us have said anything in half an hour, the abrupt declaration makes me and Edison blink stupidly. Right, I say after a minute. We've got copies of several of the physical files. So why are we assuming that the digital files are the only ones the killer is checking? There's a whole file room. I don't have a phone number for either of the Smiths, so I text Cass, who answers with a promise to have the Smiths poke at it. And then,
An hour later, she calls the conference room extension and demands to be on speaker.
"Sterling, you're a fucking genius," she announces.
"Well, yes," Sterling agrees, nonplussed.
"Why this time?" "Because there are files missing from the records room. The administrator has to go through drawer by drawer to match the files to their spreadsheets and what's been checked out legitimately, but we've got three missing from what he's checked so far."
"Ava's?"
"No, it's there, but not quite in the right place. Someone took it out and then put it back wrong. All the kids we've met are accounted for."
"Who reported the Levines to CPS?" I ask.
"A neighbor. The fence between the two houses is chain link, and she saw Ava in the pool. Bathing suit."
And a bathing suit was going to make that low belly very evident. "How far along is she? Do they know yet?"
"Ava wasn't sure because she's only ever had one period. They couldn't count back. The OB says about 18 weeks. 4.5 months.
Christ in heaven.
They've got Gloria down at the station for questioning, and a judge just signed off on a warrant to search her house and car. If she has those missing files..."
"And if she doesn't?"
"Then we ask to expand the warrant to the other clerks and administrators. I'll let you know."
We stare at the conference phone in the center of the table. "Does anyone know where my car is?" I ask after a minute. Edison snorts, and Sterling smiles.
"It's in the garage here," she informs me. "Level 4, I think."
"Thanks." A couple of hours later, when I pack up to head out, Sterling follows suit.
"Can I be your DD?" she asks quietly.
"I'm not going out drinking."
"No, but I'm guessing this has something to do with your visitor this morning, and you looked like someone told you there was a killer clown after you."
"A killer what?"
"So it's emotional, and something you have to face anyway. I'm asking if I can be your designated driver, because when you're that emotional, driving sucks. And it's hard."
"Who was your DD when you and your dickhead fiancé broke it off?"
"Finny," she says with a shrug. "Her old boss, who sent her on to us when we needed an agent, because he'd already been promoted out of the field. Vic's old partner, for a long time. And that makes a lot of sense as to why she fits with us so well. I should say, no, I've got this."
"Thanks." "I don't."
So she drives me to the hotel, and I'm willing to bet Vic is paying for the room, because my mother would never spend this kind of money on herself. It's not fancy, not luxurious or expensive. It just isn't $29 a night with a roach chorus. When I was a kid, my mother could barely countenance spending money on herself, and with God only knows how many grandkids now, I can't imagine that's changed much. I turn the card over and over in my hand, not moving, even after Sterling parks the car, brings the windows down, and cuts the engine. She doesn't ask or poke or prod or push. She just pulls out a book of crosswords and settles in.
"Do you have any makeup wipes?" I ask.
"Glove box." It feels strange, wrong even, to strip everything off in the middle of the day. But with the aid of the wipes and the sun visor mirror, I get off every bit of it. I look like hell. The bruises under my eyes, the sallowness of not enough sleep, the scars digging pink-white tracks down my cheek.
"I'm not going anywhere," Sterling tells me, without looking away from her page.
Take as much or as little time as you need.
Thank you.
Forcing myself out of the car, I head into the hotel and take the stairs to the third floor because the thought of trying to stand still in an elevator right now makes my skin crawl. The door for 314 doesn't look any different from its neighbors, plain white with a heavy lock plate under the handle. 5 minutes later, I still haven't been able to make myself knock. And then I don't have to, because the chain scratches in its tracks and the handle rotates, and the door slowly opens to reveal my mother's face.
Mercedes, she breathes.
My mother. You need to go back, I tell her. Once upon a time, there was a little girl who was scared of the world. She thought, once, that it could get better, that it could be better. She'd wanted so badly to believe that, and she had, for a time. But the thing with worlds, in the human sense, is that they come crashing down. When a whole world shatters and self-destructs, is it possible to be less than apocalyptic? Wasn't that the very meaning of the word? She'd had a few bad days after leaving the prison. It wasn't just her daddy's words ringing through her head, not just his wide, triumphant smile. It was all the other things, too, all the memories crashing in. She'd taken a few days off work, trying to get her head around all of it. She'd taken off another few days and checked into a clinic. She just couldn't stop shaking or crying or panicking. It was too much. It was all just too much. All those years of beatings and Daddy coming to her room at night, camera at the ready. Mama escaping without her? Those years of the basement and Daddy's friends. The hospital and the trial and all the foster homes, the parade of horrors too infrequently interrupted by goodness or indifference. And now her father was going to get out of prison. He was going to have another baby girl. Another daughter that he'd... But she worked through the fear and sorrow and rage as best she could. It was absurd. If her father was released early, there wasn't a chance in hell he'd be allowed near his daughter. No man with her daddy's history would be allowed near a little girl. Right? She returned to work, still shaky, but better. A little better. Getting there, maybe. She reminded herself of the good she did. She was helping children, more important now than ever. But this little boy. Here was this file on her desk, this beautiful little boy with eyes like hers, eyes that were bruised and a little broken and far too honest. There was so much proof that his parents were unfit, and yet he'd been given back to them. Again. Because there were rules and technicalities and loopholes, because there were too many children in danger, and not nearly enough money or homes or people to help. So this little boy with the shadowed soul and the two honest eyes would get hurt again and again. And again. Ronnie Wilkins needed an angel. 25.
19 years, Mercedes, and that's what you have to say to me.
Mama's face creases in still familiar irritation, and she opens the door all the way.
Get in here.
No, I'm not here to talk. You need to go back. Or go wherever you want, as long as it isn't to my job.
I didn't raise you to be this rude to your mother.
No, you raised me to be molested by my father. Her open hand cracks against my cheek, and she stares at her palm, horrified, because it's easier than looking at my scarred face. Esperanza told me about the prognosis, I continue after a moment. She told me about what you all want to do. Bring him to the house, let him die around family. But he's not dead yet, and if you think for one moment I will ever even consider letting him around children,
he never hurt any of the others.
Hurting me was enough. I can't stop you from doing the petition, but I won't be putting my name to it. Not as a victim, not as an agent, and I'll be writing the judge to speak against it.
This isn't a conversation to be having in the hallway, she frets.
We're not having a conversation, Mama. I am telling you a thing I will never do. Her hair is almost entirely silver, but still thick and healthy, braided back into a coiled knot low at the base of her skull, single hair wisps curling away from her scalp as they protest the severity. Her face is creased with wrinkles. Her dark brown eyes are the same as I remember. She's her and not her. Even her clothes are the same, an embroidered white blouse and long multi-tiered colorful skirt, the only things she'd ever buy for herself, because Papa fell in love with her in those skirts, she used to tell us. If the necklines are a little higher than they used to be, her arms thicker under the collar ruffle, well, it's been decades.
Go home, Mama, I tell her, and despite everything, my tone is gentle, almost kind.
Go home to everyone else and accept the fact that you lost your youngest daughter a very long time ago.
But I didn't lose you, she insists, tears tracking down her weathered cheeks. You are right here before me, more stubborn than ever.
You lost me the minute I told you what Papa was doing, and you said I needed to be a good daughter.
He was your papa, she says helplessly. He was...
Part of me recognizes the oddity of her speaking English. English was for school and work and errands. At home, we only spoke Spanish, unless the older kids were working on homework. The entire neighborhood, literally the entire neighborhood, was family. All the cousins and second cousins and aunts and uncles, the grandparents and almost grandparents, the older siblings who married and moved into houses just down the street or around the corner. Unless it was schoolwork, you didn't hear English until you left the neighborhood and went past the corner stores. Even then, you were as likely to hear Spanish until you got deeper into town. I take her face between my hands, lean forward, and kiss her forehead. When Vic did it to me, it was for support. Now, it's goodbye. Go home. Your daughter is lost, and she is never coming home. She found a better family on her own.
That man, that agent, she spits. He took you away.
He rescued me, once from the cabin and once from you. Goodbye, Mama. I turn and walk away, and there's a part of me aware of the sobbing little girl in the back of my mind, the hurt child who couldn't understand why her parents did what they did, why no one else cared. Be patient, I want to tell that little girl. It gets worse. But then it gets better. Then we get rescued. Sterling doesn't ask how it went when I get in the car. She just starts it up and pulls out onto the road, headed to Manassas and home.
Home. Can we stop by my house?
I ask once we're on the highway. Something I need to do.
Of course. She watches me from the corner of her eye, most of her attention still on the road. Cass called. So far, the search of Gloria's house hasn't turned up anything suspicious.
Are you serious?
They're still looking. Watson Holmes have her at the station, but they haven't questioned her yet. They're waiting for the results.
This is a terrible day, Eliza.
Yes.
My house looks the same. My cozy little cottage with its quiet colors and Jason's flowers blooming along the walk and the front of the porch. I'm not sure why I expected it to look different. It feels different now. Shouldn't it look different as well?
But it doesn't. And the keys open it the same as ever, and aside from the dust that's accumulated over the past 11 days, the inside is also unchanged. Siobhan never kept very much here, just some clothes and toiletries, and a couple of books by the bed. Her absence hasn't changed it. Even the bedroom, the bed still unmade, and probably still smelling of her a bit. I haven't been in it since the night Amelia Anders knocked on my door. The black velvet bear sits on my nightstand, and dozens of relatives line the shelf that wraps around the room. I've never likened the sight to my family's neighborhood before. Grabbing trash bags out from under the kitchen sink, I stalk back into the room and pull bears from the shelf, shoving them into bags. But every last goddamn bear is off the shelf, even if some of them are spilling across the floor. My hand closes around the black velvet one with the faded red heart and the smart bow tie, and I can't. Clasping him to my chest and trying not to think of Ava holding those damn angel bears the same way, I lean against the wall and sink to the floor, my feet sliding into the space under the bed. After a few minutes, Sterling picks her way between the bears, not stepping on any of them, and moves some aside so she can sit next to me. I'm not sure how long we sit there in silence. Long enough for the light coming through the windows to shift to dusk, for shadows to stretch across the room and distort perspectives. Once upon a time, I was the youngest of 9, I whisper eventually. I used to share a room with my 2 next youngest sisters, but when I was 5, I got my very own room up in the attic. I was so proud of it. It had a pretty pink canopy princess bed, and a white chest for dress-up clothes, and it had a lock all the way up on the top of the door, where I couldn't reach. The night of my birthday party, my very first night in the room, I found out why. I turn the bear so he's braced against my thighs, his worn face more squashed than usual. His stuffing is so old, he doesn't bounce back the way he used to. For 3 years, my father molested me, and the rest of the family ignored it. My siblings, all the adults, they knew. But the people of their generations, back in Mexico, you just don't talk about things like that. So they closed their eyes and turned away. 3 years? Sterling repeats, her own voice whisper soft. Maybe it's the kind of secret. Maybe it's the twisting light vanishing across the bedspread. There's something about the moment that says anything louder will shatter. My father also gambled. The family didn't know about that. They would have been less forgiving. All the different pieces of the family relied on each other to get by. His gambling meant he put the whole extended family in jeopardy. He got in over his head with a private group, He couldn't even sell the house to cover it. The entire neighborhood was family, so he would have had to explain.
It wasn't enough to cover it anyway.
So, he gave them you.
He sent me to play in the woods behind the house, and when no one could see me, they grabbed me. They had a cabin deeper in the woods, too deep for anyone to really go.
How long?
2 years. Sometimes I wake up and can still feel the rough boards beneath me and the manacle around my ankle. Hear the heavy chain that rattled across the wood with every movement I made.
There were some other kids there. Collateral, maybe. Or winnings?
They were never there long, but a couple of the men had taken a liking to me. Said they liked my fear. I'd been there almost 2 years when I got a chance to escape. The cabin wasn't well made. The wood wasn't finished. We'd had a wet summer, and everything was rotting. So I pulled up the ring bolt attached to my chain, wrapped it around me like a feather boa so it wouldn't clank, tiptoed past the men as they were sleeping, and ran like hell into the woods.
"You don't like woods," she says, after I fall silent. "Edison always goes in. If there's a way for it not to be you."
See. It was dark, and night, the trees too thick for moonlight. There were little ravines all over. I ran and ran and ran. I fell so often, but I dragged myself back up, more and more scared every time, and I couldn't find a way out. I was too afraid to scream. Maybe it would bring help, but it was more likely to bring the men.
They found you?
In the morning. They came out looking for me when they noticed I was gone. The chain had gotten caught in a root system, and when I tried to work it loose, I fell over the edge of a ravine. The manacle caught and broke my ankle. I was just hanging there. They beat me for trying to escape. Using the bear's soft paw, I traced the scars on my cheek. Broken bottle. She leans her head against my shoulder and waits. They put me in the root cellar after that. It was stone and the trap door had a lot of locks. I don't know if I would have been brave enough to try again, to be honest. It didn't matter. But a few days later, I woke up to yelling. Yelling and gunshots. I was huddled there in the dark, and the lock scraped, and the door opened, and there was a big man standing there. I was terrified. It could only get worse, right? But someone handed him a flashlight, and he made it dance around my feet. And he came down the stairs and knelt in front of me and said his name was Victor. I can feel her surprise, a full body startle that ends in almost the same posture.
Our Vic?
Our Vic. He told me I was going to be okay, that those men were never going to hurt me again. The men had taken the shirt I lived in, so Vic wrapped me up in his jacket while someone brought down tools to take the manacle off.
Someone else? Finney, I think.
Brought a blanket.
And a teddy bear.
I wave at her with the bear's paw and feel, more than hear, her soft huff of laughter. Vic picked me up and carried me out into this mess of stand lights, dozens of people milling around. Some of the men who had imprisoned me were dead, but most were injured or handcuffed. And as we paused, there was this momentary hush, a bubble of silence as everyone stopped to stare,
and then went back to what they were doing. I know our side of that hush. There wasn't a road that deep into the woods, no way to drive through. Vic carried me 2.5 miles to the closest access point, and the cars had their lights flashing like crazy. He took me to an ambulance, and I didn't want to let go. So he sat in there with me, as the paramedics worked on my face and ankle, and all the other wounds. He said he was going to take me home to my parents. I can't imagine that going well. I started screaming. Told him I couldn't go home, couldn't go back to my papa hurting me again. I promised to be good, begged anything so my papa couldn't touch me again. And his face did this. I honestly don't know if you've seen Vic when he's about to rain down fire and destruction. She shakes her head against my shoulder. I've seen him pissed, but not like that. Saw a hint of it with Archer's fuck-up 3 years ago, but he left that to Finney. When the hospital had done all its scans and wrapped and treated everything, he came back in with a social worker and another police officer, and they asked me about my father. My room at the house was still the same. My father couldn't change it because it would look to the rest of the family like he was giving up on my safe return. All the rest of the family thought I'd been kidnapped, even my mother. He was the only one who knew differently. So the police went, and they saw the lock and the dress-up clothes with the blood and semen on them, and the diary I had duct-taped to the back of the headboard. My father was arrested, and the men from the woods admitted I'd been given to them to settle a gambling debt. The family denied knowing anything about him molesting me. Family. She nods. They were furious when the court sent me to foster care. I was supposed to come home. Oh, but they were pissed at me, too, because I should have just said, "Thank you for rescuing me from the woods." Should have come home and kept my mouth shut, because family. I kept getting moved to different foster homes, because my relatives would show up and start harassing the adults. My tía Soledad tried to kidnap me from school a couple of times. After 3 years, my social worker got permission to move me to a different city. I've seen one of my cousins a couple of times since then, but that was it. But they won't. They won't give up on you, even though they gave up on you years ago. Yes, yes, exactly. My father has been in prison ever since, and all going as it should, he'll die there. Sooner than expected, maybe, with the cancer. That why they're trying to talk to you again? They've never really stopped. It's why I change my number so often. But yes, it's why my mother came out. Esperanza told them I work for the FBI at Quantico, that I'm an agent. There, little girl, look how far she's come. I'm the victim, and I'm an agent, and surely if I ask for him to be released so he can spend the rest of his days at home, a judge would do it. They're really asking you for that? I nod, and can't help but smile as she mutters what sounds like curses into my shirt. Did you request Vic's team? She asks, once she's subsided. No, wouldn't have, even if I could. Seemed a bit weird, trying to prove myself as an adult agent to someone who'd pulled me naked out of a root cellar when I was 10. When I received the assignment, he took me out to lunch before I even got to meet Edison, and we sat and talked to see if we could both do this. He said there was no shame if the answer was no. He'd make sure I got assigned to another team, no stigma, no gossip. At the end of the day, though, the bear is a comforting, familiar brush against my cheek. 22 years of cuddling and nightmares and triumphs.
We were in a car accident once, me and the bear, and I wouldn't let the paramedics touch me until they'd stitched up the bear's arm, even though my own arm was bleeding all over the place. I was 12. He was the reason I became an FBI agent. He pulled me out of absolute hell, and his kindness made me feel like maybe safe was a thing I could be someday. He rescued me, saved me. And it wasn't about trying to repay him, but just, I wanted to do that for others. He gave me my life back. And now, someone is using your history against you, she murmurs, lightly touching the bear's bow tie with one fingertip. I don't think they mean to. I think this is them trying to give that gift to others. We sit in silence until I finally ask the question I try not to ask any agent. Why are you in CAC, Eliza?
Because my best friend's father was a serial killer, she answers calmly. She actually smiles a little. I told Priya that 3 years ago. Archer was being an ass to her. My best friend's father was a serial killer, and even though he murdered grown women, I saw what it did to the kids when the truth came out. I used to have sleepovers at her place all the time. He tucked us into bed. And he did all that. I wanted to understand it. I never have, of course. But it left me obsessively researching criminals and psychology, and one day, when I was home from college for winter break, my dad asked me if I was going to make a career out of it.
You hadn't even thought about it, had you?
No. I mean, I had a couple of psychology and criminology classes under my belt, but it was only my sophomore year. I'd only just finished up my gen eds and was trying to decide on a major. But he got me to realize that I could put that motivation to work helping others. And I chose CAC because I'm still friends with Shira, and I remember how terrible it was when we found out about her father. And I wanted to help kids. CAC lets me do that.
After a while, she gets to her feet and offers her hand to help me stand. We look around the mess of teddy bears on the floor. I don't have any more garbage bags in the kitchen.
Leave it, she advises. Come back to it later. Decide then. You've been collecting them for years, and this is a really bad time to make important decisions.
Tossing teddy bears is a big decision.
It is when they remind you of why you're here.
You're a wise soul, Eliza Sterling.
I think we take turns with it. Given everything else, it would be irresponsible of me to get you drunk. So, hopefully, this will be enough.
My phone rings. I pull it out of my pocket, but I can't bring myself to answer it. Not if it means another child dead. Sterling takes it from my hand, checks the display, and thumbs the call to speak.
Kearney, you've got Mercedes and Sterling here.
Awesome.
Cass's voice sounds tinny and distant, like maybe she's using the speakerphone as well.
Burnside went through every single file access in the office the last few weeks and took special note of which ones were accessed without additional information being added. The ones most likely to be superfluous access.
Okay. Does that point to Gloria?
That's where it gets a bit weird.
How do you mean?
For one thing, a lot of the access to our kids' files, among others, was done on Gloria's chemo days. File clerks don't have remote access.
So someone else is using Gloria's login. Could it be Lee?
If it was, it wasn't from his computer. It's clean, and the clerks probably would have noticed if he'd been out there on Gloria's computer. The really weird part is that there's one search that comes up almost every day that isn't in Manassas CPS jurisdiction. It's over in Stafford, and there is no active CPS file for that address. Can you think of why someone would do a daily search